Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Welcome to the Sufi Pilgrim's Progress podcast number 4. Today the title of the podcast will be The Low and the High. And you'll see what I mean shortly. The inspiration for this talk came from a near-death experience that I had been reading about this month. Now, as many of you know, I have had a long-term interest in near-death experiences. I think they give us information that we can't really get so clearly anywhere else. I consider these people, Islamically speaking, shahids, not in the sense of being martyrs, but in the sense of being witnesses. And they are witnesses to the au-delà, as they say in French, to the other side. So when they report back to us what they have seen, we get kind of a fresh version of what our prophets and saints and mystics have told us since the beginning of time. But we get it in a kind of contemporary language that is very accessible, and then again that confirms our prior beliefs in most cases, at least if we're Muslim and Christian and Jewish. There's a lot of confirmation in these reports of the teachings of the holy books of the great religions, more so of the Western religions than of the Eastern ones, but we'll talk about that at a later point in time, and I'm writing about it currently. Okay, so this lady had a very bad delivery, c'était l'accouchement, and she was hemorrhaging a lot, and so they had to do a hysterectomy, and she was put under anesthesia. And she doesn't really remember exactly what happened on the other side. Usually the NDE people, they remember seeing the light or being on the other side. She doesn't remember that as much as she remembers, she noticed what the effect was on her, and she remembers very clearly what it meant to come back into the body. So this is the low. Okay, and this is what we live with on a daily basis, except most of the time we're not really aware of what it really means to be in a body. We'll talk about why that might be. But let's hear what she has to say as she's re-entering from the other side. She says, I'd resisted going back to my body. I'm going to translate this part in French for the Francophones. I'd resisted going back to my body because of its density, weakness, slowness, heaviness, and eventual decay towards a painful death. I'm going to repeat that because it's important. We try to live in denial of this, and contemporary culture is always denying the issue of sickness, decay, and death. But this lady is experiencing it. It's density, weakness, think about it, slowness, heaviness, and eventual decay towards a painful death. Et là, je vais le dire en français pour les francophones. La madame, elle revient dans son corps, elle devient très consciente de l'aspect densité, faiblesse, retard, slowness, lenteur, lourdeur, and eventual decay et son décadence éventuelle vers un mort pénible. Okay. Now, when I read this, it brought a lot of things to mind. One of the things it brought to mind is a kind of greeting they have in, especially here in Quebec, I've noticed at New Year's, and the people tell you, Happy New Year's, je te souhaite la santé, c'est la santé qui est le principal. I wish you good health, it's good health, that's the most important thing. And if there are people I don't know, I usually just let it pass. But if I have people I think they can benefit from a little teaching, I say the following. I say, si la santé est le principal, on est tout foutu. If health is the most important thing, we're all, I don't want to swear, but SCR-D. No, but the other word says it more. You can spell it out for yourself. I don't want to say it. But if that's, we're all in trouble, if that's the principal thing is just our physical health, we're all, okay, doomed. Why? Because all of us are destined to get sick and die. Every one of us, 100% statistically certain death. And almost always preceded by varying lengths of sickness and ill health. So if health is the most important thing, we're in deep trouble. So the people who are a little more intelligent will say, so what's the most important thing? And I say faith. Okay, now faith is not very popular, la foi. It's not very popular in modern circles, but nevertheless, it's a reminder to them not to get too attached to this physical world. Now the lady goes on and she says some very interesting things. She said, more than anything else, I did not want to have to stay in this horrid physical meat body and feel what it felt all the way through what I knew would be a very long, painful dying process. Okay, this horrid physical meat body. Now I've heard Buddhists say something similar, calling the body the meat sack. Okay, now, in a way, this speaks to me also personally, because I remember being revolted when I was a young medical student by everything we saw happening to the body. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why, at some point in time, I shifted into psychiatry. There was too much ugliness around bodily processes. Of course, most of them were sick, but even the ones that aren't sick. Okay, now we live in a culture that idealizes the body in many ways. So we have all these advertisements everywhere losing weight, for developing muscles, for not having wrinkles. People have become totally obsessed with the body, and so it's not in its rightful place anymore. And part of the contribution to this, unfortunately, it must be said, are artists who spread the message that the body is a sacred, holy thing. It's not. It contains a sacred, holy thing, but it in itself is problematic on many levels and not nearly as beautiful as the artists and sculptors and whoever else, ideologues of worldly existence, would like us to think. So, yes. Yes, we have a question from the audience.
What about, I believe it's in the Bible or in the Christian tradition, that the body is a temple?
Yes, okay, so we have a millennial contradiction here. But we won't deal with the opposition party at this point in time. But suffice it to say that the body is an instrument. It's true. Even a temple. What's the good of a temple? The temple has no purpose other than the people inside it who are praying and what they're praying to. The temple in itself is not holy. It's the people, the prayers, their contact with God. So the temple is actually part of the world. It's made, if you take it apart, it's made of stones and mortar and bricks, and there's nothing special about it.
Okay, I think I get it now.
Oh, okay.
The temple is what you use for your devotion.
Yeah. The body is a tool. That is true. And the body can be a very useful or a necessary tool even for spiritual development, but it shouldn't be seen as an idol. It shouldn't be worshipped. And it should be just be given its relative importance. We're obligated to try to maintain it, to keep it in good health, etc., but we're not obligated to worship it. Now, I had a very interesting experience about this lowliness when I was in Jerusalem, of all places. I was in the old city of Jerusalem. This is probably just after, I believe, just after I'd converted to Islam. I was in the old city of Jerusalem, and I was walking from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Have you been there? Yeah, to the Masjid al-Aqsa. There was a road there, and there was some digging going on. Okay, I was afraid to talk about this because there'll be some conspiratorial theory about what the Israelis are doing to undermine al-Aqsa. But no, this was some sewage work. But there was something about the quality of the earth that they were digging in, which I've seen a lot of ditches and trenches in Canada and elsewhere, but it never had quite the same feeling. I could see, if you wish, inwardly, the mud. In the Quran it's called clay, but it's similar to, it's a form of mud that our bodies were made from. And I could see the difference between it and the holiness of the places around, and the holiness of our inwardness. There was something about it that was particularly, the Arabic word is kathif, I think, particularly coarse, you know, and low about that mud. And yet we are made from it. There are contradictions in existence. And yes, that is what we're made from. And the Quran tells us we're made from clay. And that's one of the reasons that the shaitan resists bowing down to Adam, because he said he's only made of clay, I'm made of fire, it's a higher entity, etc., etc.
Isn't that the point?
Isn't that the point? What?
That we are incarnate, the pure spirit in a body, because we need this connection to the earth.
Yeah, well,
and deal with this reality.
Yes. We're caught here in some aspects are paradoxical, some aspects are mysterious, and there's no doubt that this was created by God. This body and this world was created by God, so there must be goodness in it. I'm not arguing. You see, what's going to happen here is that all the people that usually would be listening to it, and all the people I know have been overeducated. And in being overeducated, they like to think of everything in black and white terms. I get this all the time on my Facebook page. But things are not black and white. Things are not just good and just evil. Everything contains within it its own contradiction, if you want. Rumi was the first one who pointed this out to me, and he said, I think it was in the Mathnavi, any person who doesn't realize that nature is made of contradictions is not fully enlightened. Okay, but we're taught to be rationalists, and in rational thought, A cannot be not A. Okay, but in reality, A can be not A. So things can be good and bad and gray and nuanced, and black and white thinking is a problem. The CBT people know it, but the politicians don't. I want to continue with what this lady says, because I think it's really important to hear the message beyond the mind productions that might object to the message. Yet I knew in a way that what I'd never known before, that pain and decay was the only way to be free of it. Okay, so here we're in an area of mystery. Pain and decay is the only way to be free of it. On ne peut pas passer à travers. How would you translate decay in French? It's not la corruption.
Désagrégation, décomposition.
Décomposition, ok. Que la douleur et la décomposition du corps sont inhérents à l'existence et sont comme la seule façon de s'en aller vers l'au-delà. So we can't avoid it. The Buddhists know it. Life is suffering is the first noble truth. The Muslims know it, the Jews know it, the Christians with the figure of Christ. Well, we don't accept that he was crucified, but the figure, the image is correct. Life is suffering. There's no way around it. There's only through it. And so she's realizing this in a very deep way. It was like you're locked into your seat on a big roller coaster and the cars begin to move forward and you know there's no way off the ride. That's life. We're in this. Eventually this body, despite all the beautiful advertisements of young people that are out there enjoying themselves, as they get older, the body decomposes, decays, gives more and more trouble, more and more pain, and eventually dies. That's the harsh reality of this world. Now, alhamdulillah for the believers and astaghfirullah for the non-believers. Because the people who realize this and take it seriously, like the existentialists, for example, end up being suicidal. What's the point? That if there's no odla, if there's no other side, there's no point to this suffering. It's all useless suffering. And anyone with half a mind realizes that there's more suffering than pleasure in this life. Sheikh Nazim used to say 40 units of pain to 1 unit of pleasure. Now, people might disagree with that, but, you know, you see someone in intense pain and you see someone in pleasure and there's no equivalence, you know, unless maybe they're having some ecstatic pleasure, but that's very rare. Now, the same lady, we may only actually, how many minutes are we in?
17 minutes.
We may actually only be able to cover the low today, and we'll have to cover the high next week. It's okay, something to look forward to, the beautiful part. This is a very interesting part also of this particular near-death experience. This lady then, she's in a hospital room after her hysterectomy, and it's a semi-private hospital room, probably somewhere in the United States. And then another woman is led in. Okay, and she says the following. The semi-quiet of the ward, anyone's been in the hospital knows what she's talking about, shattered with a wailing, moaning voice. La yan fam ki rand ki kri ki grang. That progressed down the hall towards the room I was in. A team of nurses wielding an elderly woman and femme and vieille femme, her hands flailing, ses mains dans l'air, elle criait, she was in pain, and she was screaming, no one cares about me, tout le monde s'en fout. Sa fille était là, her daughter was there, and helped the nurses to settle in and was trying to say soothing words to her. Sa fille est là et essaie de l'aider en disant des mots gentils. So our reporter is saying, I lay listening to the turmoil and rushing about. The lady was weeping and screaming like an animal. Elle criait et elle pleurait comme un animal. Les infirmières ne savaient pas quoi faire. And il voyait que sa fille ne pouvait pas la calmer. Il voulait la mettre dans les contraintes. So the nurses, as they are often prone to do, want to put her in restraints. So as they used to do in psychiatry, so she won't make so much noise. But the daughter didn't let them. Et elle continuait à parler doucement. So the daughter keeps speaking quietly and calmly to her mother, and eventually the mother falls asleep. Okay. So here we have the picture of another kind of pain associated with life. This lady, in all likelihood, she's in some form of dementia, maybe Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia, ou delirium. Elle a perdu la tête et elle crie sans que personne l'aime. No one loves me. I'm in pain. Why doesn't anyone do anything about it? And this is another form of pain and suffering. This is more on the psychological level, just as painful as on the physical level. In fact, more painful. Okay. We're really dealing with the lower side, but let's continue. When I was a psychiatric resident, I'll tell you a little story about pain, and then we'll conclude this episode. Next week it will be more joyous and elevating. When I was still a resident in psychiatry, I was in the emergency room, and I get a call from the ward that I need to come over. There were a bunch of people in the emergency room that needed to be evaluated, but the nurse was insistent. I refused because I had too much work to do in the emergency room, and I got a call from the director of the hospital telling me, you have to go. I said, but I have some. He said, yeah, but if we don't listen to this nurse, there's hell to pay. You know, she's going to make our life miserable for the whole year. So even if it's irrelevant, go. Okay. So I come up to the, I have to leave all my patients in the emergency room, go up to the ward, and there's a bunch of nurses around this patient, and they're all yelling, she's a manipulator, she just wants attention, she's a personality disorder, you know, do something, doctor. So I go up to the patient and I say, what happened? She said, I was feeling, think of the woman we just heard about. She said, I was feeling so terrible, so much angst, angoisse, that I couldn't, and the medication wasn't working. So the only solution I found was to break the window pane, take a shard of the window, of this pane, and cut myself on my wrist. And as soon as I felt the cut, all the anguish disappeared. We know about this in psychiatry. It's called self-harm, self-cutting. So she said, then I could continue living because it was only physical pain. It's an interesting story. I looked at the nurses. I was the smart aleck then. I looked at the nurses and I said to them, sorry, guys, I don't call this manipulation. I call this survival. And ever since then, I reject the term manipulation. People are doing what they need to do to survive. And this lady was there the next morning to greet us. And the cut healed up in a few days. She had found a solution. It isn't a particularly pretty solution. But we can see here that the psychic pain can be worse than the physical pain. So this is the abode of suffering. I think it was Junaid al-Baghdadi, one of the great Sufis, who said, I have said my janaza to the things of this world. Janaza is the funeral prayer. He said, I've given up on the things of this world because this world is the place of anxiety and distress and suffering, and that's just what it is. Now, the other side is we can use that as a tool, this experience for our betterment in the hereafter. And that's what we're called upon to do by all the spiritual teachings. And we'll talk about where that brings us. We'll talk about where that brings us the next time when we talk about the high side of the low. Any other questions? No? Yes. Okay, one question. And
I believe from my own experience that psychic pain is worse than physical pain for one reason. Psychic pain, you don't know.
Excuse me, can this be heard?
Just a bit.
Okay, so I, from my experience, what I believe is that psychic pain is worse than physical pain for the only reason that physical pain, there is a reason for it. The psychic pain, you don't know what, so you start asking yourself all these questions that do as much harm as the anxiety itself by feeling that maybe you did something to deserve this.
Okay. Yes. This is part of a common misconception, which I actually even heard from one of my own teachers and supervisors, which is actually for whom I have a lot of respect, and I won't name him, but that somehow we have control over our mind productions. So that if you go to a general practitioner and you say you're suffering from something and he doesn't find anything in his tests, he says it's all in your head. As if, because it's all in your head, you can change it. Actually, most of the thought processes in our mind, we can't change, you know. And the people who are sophisticated about these things, like the cognitive therapists, for example, who work with that, know that these thought processes are a given. Then we can try to adapt, and then we can try to see if there are not other thought processes. But the underlying current of thought processes, we have very little control over. And we can see this even in our Islamic practice. If people are observant, and I find a lot of born Muslims are not that observant about what happens in their thought process, for example, during Ramadan, but when you're fasting, it changes your way of thinking. Now, I know a lot of people in some of the Arabic countries, oh, fasting for me, it's nothing, I'm like I always am. But then you speak to people who are tourists in those countries or are working in those countries from elsewhere, they say, no, they aren't. They're not like they are usually. They're more irritable, they're more impatient, etc., etc. The point being that your thought processes and even your emotional states are much less under your control than people think they are. And in fact, they're harder to change. So that if a doctor tells you it's all in your mind, it's all in your head, you could legitimately answer, well, that makes it even worse because I have even less control over that than what's going on in my body. Okay, so the mind-body conundrum, and especially the mind-body-soul conundrum, we will look at in our next talk about the higher aspects of existence. Today was about the lower ones and about not denying it. That is part of reality. Subhana rabbika rabbil izzati ahmi yasifun. وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين.